Yesterday we talked about the character of Muslim-Christian relations in this archipelago over the past 400 years and emphasized that character, the character was that of crusades. And we are all, I think, painfully aware that Muslim Filipinos and Christian Filipinos are in a situation of conflict. And partly the conflict is the result of the conditioning of 400 years of hostility. The present conflict is but the latest chapter in a long history of violent encounter between Muslims and Christians in this archipelago. And today, the mass of Muslim Filipinos find themselves caught between the forces of integration, which they perceive as assimilation, and the forces of secession. There are among the Muslim Filipinos very strident voices saying that it's hopeless, we cannot be equal citizens with Christians in the Republic of the Philippines. We cannot find justice in the structure of the Republic. It's absolutely hopeless. The only thing we can do is to secede entirely and set up a republic of our own. Now, as I say, Muslim Filipinos today are caught in a violent suspension between the forces of integration and the forces of secession. I find it personally rather helpful in trying to analyze this situation by making a distinction between what I would call an inflammable condition and an inflamed situation. Now, if you are living in a bamboo, a nipa house, and a friend comes up into your kitchen or into your house with a can of kerosene, and he trips and falls, and the kerosene spreads all over the floor, you find yourself in a highly inflammable condition. And if another friend comes up into your house and he lights up a cigarette and drops the still lighted match on the floor, you are likely to find yourself in an inflamed situation. The inflammable condition will suddenly burst into flame. And I think that we can understand our present history in Muslim-Christian relations in terms of inflammable condition and inflamed situation. Let's look first at the elements of the inflammable condition that has become inflamed. First, there have been, as we've described over the yesterday in particular, there have been the centuries, four centuries of hostilities between Muslims and Christians, as from a Muslim point of view, they were fighting for the maintenance of their independence, fighting for their religion, fighting for the preservation of their customs and life ways. Secondly, contributing to the inflammable condition has been the negative moral image. The negative moral image that has been the psychosociological burden of 400 years of hostility, where Muslims have perceived that Christians look down upon them as a dirty, backward, unprogressive, violent people, pirates, slavers, etc., etc., etc. There has been an equally negative Christian image on the part of the Muslims. The Christians are liars and cheats and land grabbers. They are untrustworthy. They are immoral. You know, They say that they are cleave to only one wife, but in fact there's the Garida system, and they are immoral. And there is there's an equally negative Christian image that is likewise the product of centuries of Muslim-Christian hostility. Well, these equally negative images of one another are an important element in the inflammable condition. The sense of nationality. Yesterday, I picked up the point I should have made the day before yesterday, that the adoption by some Filipinos in the south of Islam helped to shape them into a society, not one culture, but one society, with a real sense of nationality. And this sense of nationality has been in many ways frustrated in its natural tendency towards embodiment in a state. And the fact that that the majority population has not been sensitive to the existence of this sense of nationality and been more accommodating to it has contributed to the inflammable condition. Another element is the inability of Muslims to accept the fact of their conquest. It is a fact. From a Muslim point of view, it's a very ugly reality, something that they will not face up to. But the fact is that Muslim Filipinos have been incorporated into the Philippine nation against their will. There was not a time when the Moros had a vote, had the opportunity to vote, to say we were going to be part of the Philippine nation. They were forced into the Philippine state system against their will. They fought bravely but unsuccessfully against this incorporation. And many have not accepted emotionally the fact of their incorporation. All the more so because after their incorporation, from their own point of view, they have been treated as second-class citizens. It is also an ugly fact. And not many Christians, I find, face up to this fact, that the majority population hasn't made it very easy for Muslims to accept their incorporation into the Philippine state system. And it would seem that certain aspects of policy, there's been an effort to rub the noses of Muslims in the fact of their conquest and to treat them as second-class citizens. This is from their own perception, and it's an important element. These feelings are an important element in the existence of an inflammable condition. Another very important element has been the massive influx of Christians from the Visayas and Luzon into Mindanao. This process started under the Spaniards. It was accelerated to some extent under the Americans, but it exploded in the time of the Commonwealth, and most especially since the Second World War. After 1936, there has been a massive immigration or migration of Filipinos from the northern and central provinces into what the Muslims regarded as Morolandia, their homeland. And at first, they could acquiesce. There was lots and lots of room. But over time, the living space became crowded. And no longer is Mindanao a frontier. The valuable lands and the valuable resources have all been claimed. And the Muslims have continued to feel more and more squeezed in their own homeland. They feel that their descendants, who have prior claim on Morolandia, are going to be deprived of what they feel is their natural birthright. And so accompanying the massive migration of Christians from the north and central islands has come then a competition for land. And this has been especially true in Mindanao and in the Cotabato area and in the northern Lanao area. And this has been this competition for land, this massive influx of what Muslims rightly or wrongly regard as outsiders has contributed mightily to the inflammable condition. Also, in time, Muslims came to perceive that they were in a status of second-class citizenship, and there was imbalance, economic imbalance, educational imbalance, social imbalance. And these perceptions, these feelings, are justly based or not. I'm not talking about whether this is true. What is true is that Muslims have perceived this to be true. Huh? And the feeling of economic imbalance in favor of the majority population, the feeling of economic neglect has been especially severe in the Sulu Archipelago. The competition in the situation in Sulu has not been so much competition over land or even large influx of Christians. This has not been so in the Sulu Archipelago. But it has the Suluanos have felt economically disadvantaged and deprived. All right, now all of these things make up the kerosene that has been spilled in this area and has contributed to an inflammable condition. But now we have had matches. We've had people lighting matches, flicking the ashes from their cigarettes and their cigars on this inflammable situation, this inflammable condition, and have made an inflamed situation. Let's talk about some of these matches. And some of these matches have been deliberately lighted. Lighted by Muslims. Lighted by Christians. Deliberately. I think the biggest match of all, and certainly the one that Muslims point to most readily, is the Corregidor incident of March 1968. Do you remember? This is more than 10 years ago now. Do you remember the Corregidor incident, where a group of Muslim trainees who were recruited for guerrilla training by the armed forces of the Philippines, a group of these Muslim trainees from Sulu, who had begun their training in Simanul Island, were transferred to Corregidor Island, where they were undergoing guerrilla jungle warfare training. And apparently a group of them mutinied. And the reasons for their mutiny are not altogether clear. The version given out in the press at the time, and I followed the press very closely, the version given out at the time was that they had not received their pay for months. And they were saying, since we are not being paid, we demand to go home. And so the fact that they weren't being paid contributed to their mutiny. Another version from the Muslim side, and has had a good deal of corroboration, actually, is that the Muslim trainees were told what the purpose or objective of their training was. In the beginning, according to this story, they were told that they were going to be used in aid of certain political interests internally in the country. And indeed, former senator, now imprisoned, Benigno Aquino, told me personally that these Corregidor trainees were being prepared to assist in election campaigns for his opposition. But according to this other version, the trainees were told the real purpose for their training, and that was to assist in the prosecution of the Philippine claim to Saba, that they would be sent into Saba on infiltration missions, and that they might very well be in a position of fighting fellow Muslims. And when they saw, according to this story, the real reason for their training, they refused and mutinied. That is, they disobeyed their superiors. And then we come back now to the bare facts of the matter. Some 28 leaders of these Muslim trainees were told, come, get your things together, you'll be flown back home. And they were taken to the far end of an airfield, and there they were summarily executed, 28 of them. A 29th person escaped. He was wounded. He fell over the cliff at the end of the airfield into the water. He was picked up by a fisherman. He was taken to the governor of Cavite, and the whole Corregidor incident became a cause célèbre in Philippine politics. Well, many, many Muslims were shocked at the inhumanity of this, what they called the Jabida massacre, because these trainees were called the Jabida Commandos. This was the code name, Jabida, for a Jabida operation, and they were Jabida Commandos. And these Muslims, therefore, according to the Muslim view, were subjected to the Jabida massacre. And this, it brought home to many, particularly younger Muslims, and also to Muslim politicians, that the Philippine armed forces in particular and the majority population in general considered the lives of Muslim human beings as nothing. And two consequences flowed from the Corregidor incident of March 1968. One was the formation of what was at first called the Muslim Independence Movement, later the Mindanao Independence Movement, under the leadership of former Cotabato governor Dato Udtug Matalan. And while the Mindanao Independence Movement was never more than a local phenomenon, it caught the imagination of many Muslims elsewhere in the Philippines that yes, maybe independence is what is the only avenue for us. And more ominous than the Mindanao Independence Movement, which was quite open and received a good deal of publicity in the Philippine papers, more ominous were the secret meetings of students, Muslim students in the Manila area, with certain key Muslim politicians, chief among them Rashid al-Luqman, who was a congressman at the time. And these Muslim students came to the conclusion that in the final analysis, a complete break with the Republic was called for, and that they must prepare themselves for the struggle for moral liberation. And the seeds of the Moro National Liberation Front, and the seeds for the vision of the Bangsa Moro Republic were sown at the time of the Jabida massacre, the Corregidor incident. And these young Muslims, some in Manila, many in Mindanao, began to go abroad for guerrilla training in Malaysia and elsewhere. All right, that was a match. That was a match. Lighted and thrown into the inflamed condition of the South. In mid-1970, you had another match. This time, written by, lighted by Feliciano Luces, alias Toothpick. And those of you who come from Cotabato can speak more authoritatively about what happened. As Feliciano Luces and Ilongo, farmer, whose family had suffered under Maguindanao Island pressures and terrorism, began to organize Tirirai and other and some Ilongos into a kind of counter-terrorist operation. And the violence which Toothpick and his followers, who came to be called Ilaga, inaugurated this spread, Ilagas or Ilaga, rats, spread elsewhere in Cotabato. And this was part of the, this was another lighted match set off the inflammable condition. Yet another one was the November 1971 elections. The November 1971 elections, which resulted, you see, in many places, particularly in Cotabato and northern Lanao, the non-Muslims had become the majority population. The Muslims who had been a majority in their own homeland in the course of about 25 or 30 years suddenly found themselves as a minority in their own homeland. And while for a while there was a kind of political accommodation where Christians would actually vote for Muslim politicians, and Muslims controlled in many areas a political power, but under the wait a while, where Muslims had in some places control of political life, by November 1971, political power was shifting, and by the elections of 1971 had shifted from Muslim to Christian control. This was true in the province of Lanao del Norte and in a number of places locally in the Cotabato region. And so not only were the Muslims in a disadvantaged status economically and in terms of land, now they were disadvantaged, thoroughly disadvantaged in their own homeland politically. Well, as I say, this contributed, and the violence which accompanied that, what were they called? The barracudas, the bully boys of a Muslim politician in Lanao del Norte. I better not mention his name. He's still very much around, isn't he, Bob? And Ilaga northern Lanao situation. There was a good deal of violence and some massacres in that area. These were also matches, huh? The contributing or these matches, by the way, were lighted by the traditional Muslim leaders who saw their own position and status being threatened permanently. Now, matches were lighted deliberately by provocateurs, both Christian and Muslims, who stood as individuals, stood to gain by an inflamed situation. You had matches being lighted all over the place by the snowballing effect of escalated violence. And I must say that another major match that has contributed to the inflamed situation was the imposition of martial law. Martial law did not create the violence in the South. But it has certainly aggravated, agitated, exacerbated the violence in the South. It has not, the violence after martial law became wide open warfare. And the MNLF, which had been underground, came to the surface and seized the leadership of the Muslim struggle for independence at first. All right, so these are some of the elements of the inflammable condition, and these are some of the matches that have contributed to making this inflammable condition an inflamed situation. And this is part of the condition of Muslims today between integration and secession. Let us look at the position of Muslim Filipinos from their own religious point of view. What is the religious position? The religious position of Muslim Filipinos between integration and secession. It is widely said by Christians mostly, and Muslims who speak to Christian audiences, it is widely said that the war in the South is not a religious war. Christians honestly believe it. Christians have a marvelous ability of compartmentalizing life and saying, well, now this is a religious question, this is a social question, this is a political question, this is an economic question, and they will point to political, economic, and social issues that that are the cause, they say, of the war. Muslims are unable to make such a beautiful compartmentalization of life. Every aspect of life. And when you start to think about it, this is true of Christians, no less than Muslims. But every aspect of life is intimately penetrated by religion as far as the Muslims are concerned. Everything about their life they believe finds its sanction in God's will. And I hope to make this a little more clear as we discuss the situation of Muslim Filipinos from a religious point of view. First of all, one has simply got to understand that Muslim Filipinos, even those who do not have a sophisticated grasp of the major tenets and customs of their religion, normative Islam, even those whose Islam is permeated by a great deal of pre-Islamic, even un-Islamic customs and beliefs, nevertheless, Muslim Filipinos anchor their psychological identity in their religion. Their religion gives them a world view, an integrated world view, and an understanding of their place in God's creation, and their worth as human beings, and the meaning of their lives. They are Muslims. That is the highest estate of man. That is from their point of view. I dare say that J. Abrams would say to be a born-again Christian is the highest estate of man, and he naturally believes that. God bless him. And so do the rest of you. But Muslims also believe that that the highest estate that they could possibly aspire to is to be a Muslim offering absolute surrender, obedience to Allah. That is in church. We Christians feel that a Christian cannot be, there's something, there's an aberration about a Christian who is apart from a church. And that the ideal for a Christian is to belong to the body of Christ, the church.
Huh?
And this is parallel to what the Muslims feel about Ummah. And Dr. Mahul has written that the question is not whether or not a Muslim wants to belong to an Ummah. The fact is he cannot be completely a Muslim apart from Ummah. And I think in looking at the warfare in the southern Philippines, we have to keep that in mind as part of the thinking of Muslims. What they seek to do is to protect and to advance, to further the Ummah idea in their midst. And when they ask for autonomy or struggle for secession, in essence, this is what they are struggling for. Ummah. Now, a third element in this discussion we've got to keep in mind is the concept of Dar al-Islam. The Dar al-Islam, the household of believers. The household of those who are obedient. The household of Muslims. Dar al-Islam. And at one stage, a large part of the southern Philippines were clearly part of the territory of believers. Clearly part of Dar al-Islam. But then the Dar al-Islam in the Philippines was subject to conquest. And the question is, what is the, from an Islamic point of view, what is the juridical status of the Muslim areas of Mindanao and Sulu at the present time? Can we still talk about Dar al-Islam in the southern Philippines? It's now part, been incorporated into the Republic of the Philippines, which is governed predominantly by Christians. Does that mean that the Muslim areas of the southern Philippines have lost their Dar al-Islam status? This is a very serious question that Muslims ask. And Muslim legists, lawyers, jurisconsults, have determined that a territory that has been once part of Dar al-Islam can lose that status under three conditions. One, where no laws of Islam are respected or enforced. Where no laws of Islam are respected and enforced. Where, that is, the laws of the unbelievers hold absolute sway. That is not a condition that pertains in the southern Philippines at the present time. There are certain customs and laws that are permitted to Muslims under the Republic of the Philippines. Another is that the territory must be completely surrounded by Dar al-Harb, that is the territory of the unbelievers, the territory of those who are hostile to Islam. The territory that was Dar al-Islam must be completely surrounded by Dar al-Harb, the territory of the unbelievers. That is not the case in the southern Philippines. The Muslim areas of Mindanao and Sulu are contiguous to Indonesia and Malaysia across the waters. And they are clearly part of Dar al-Islam. A third condition is that Muslims are not permitted to worship or observe their Eid celebrations. That does not pertain in the southern Philippines. They are permitted to worship. There is religious liberty. And so Muslims have said, we are still Dar al-Islam. Still Dar al-Islam. We are in a condition of Dar al-Aman. We are in a condition of Dar al-Aman, a household of trust. We have entered into an understanding with the non-Muslim rulers of this land that some of our laws and our religion and customs will be protected under the legal protection for religious liberty. Now, the problem is that many, many Muslims have perceived that the Republic of the Philippines is reneging on the provisions of Dar al-Aman, the Republic of the Philippines is seeking to destroy Islam in the Philippines. They charge loudly that they are subjected to genocide, if not actual physical genocide, and many believe that this is what's happening. The biggest weapons in the armed forces of the Philippines are being applied against the Muslims. And whole villages are being wiped out. And many Muslims believe that they are being subjected to physical genocide. Well, there are many other Muslims who say, no, it's not physical genocide. It is cultural genocide that we are being subjected to. And the feeling is very strong, that the Republic of the Philippines has a concerted policy. I believe this is not true. And what I believe is not important. It's what these Muslims believe that I'm trying to stress here. They believe that the Republic of the Philippines is exerting a concerted policy to change Dar al-Islam into Dar al-Harb, to destroy Islam. Listen to this excerpt from the Constitution and bylaws of the Muslim independence movement. It is the duty and obligation of every Muslim to wage jihad, physically or spiritually, to change Dar al-Aman, the present status of Muslim communities, to Dar al-Islam, Islamic territory, and prevent it from becoming Dar al-Harb, hostile territory to the Muslim. This is written in the Constitution and bylaws of the Muslim independence movement. All right, so these are elements in understanding the situation from an Islamic religious point of view. And you do not find this discussed in the national media. I've never seen an article on this in the Daily Express, or Bulletin Today, or even Times Journal. These are not matters that are discussed there. But these are part of the thinking and the emotion of Muslim Filipinos. But I want to stress another point. Some time ago, I read a book by Patrick O'Farrell entitled Ireland's English Question. The English are constantly talking about the Irish question, in the same way that Christians are always talking about the moral problem, or nowadays they say the Mindanao problem. Well, if the Christians have a moral problem, believe thee me, the Moros have a Christian problem. And if the English have an Irish question, the Irish have an English question. And the parallels between the situation of Catholics in Ireland vis-a-vis Protestants are remarkable. They are by no means identical situations, but there are certain parallels. And one of the most arresting parallels that I found in reading Patrick O'Farrell's book was his distinction between the age of faith the age of faith, and the age of politics. And he stressed that the Irish Catholics are a very religious people, have continued to be a very devout Catholic people. And they are very much in the age of religion. Very much in the age of religion. Whereas the Protestant Christians of Northern Ireland and Christianity in general in Britain is in an age of politics. As secularization has gained momentum. And governments under Protestant control in Northern Ireland and Britain do not shape public policy on the basis of religious convictions, religious beliefs, religious ideas. They base them on more or less secular ideals. And he stressed that in an age of faith, all politics is religious. And in an age of politics, all religion is political. Now, you know, I think we are in somewhat the same situation here in the Philippines. The Philippine Christian majority, particularly in the cities and among the more educated people, is becoming quite secular. Secularization is gaining momentum in the Philippines. And we are in the Christian areas, we are definitely in the age of politics. And from our purview in the age of politics, we look upon the Muslims of the southern Philippines and say that, well, when they talk about that they are fighting for Islam and for the preservation of their religious identity, that's just a political smokescreen. That's a religious smokescreen behind which they are hiding essentially economic and political motivations. There is not a disposition in the Christian areas of the Philippines to take seriously the religious convictions of Muslim Filipinos. And the idea is to believe that when they talk in Islamic religious terms, this is just a smokescreen. Likewise, from among the Muslims in the southern Philippines, who are still very much, it is my contention, still very much in an age of faith, they look upon the political policies of the majority population as nothing but an effort to alienate them from their religion and culture. When Christian Filipinos say, we are not against the Islamic religion. There is religious liberty in the Philippines. We have laws that protect the cultural and religious pluralism of this country. We are not against the Islamic religion. Christians really believe it. They honestly believe that. Muslims are not disposed to accept the sincerity of the Christians when they say that. And Muslims feel that a lot of the laws and policies of the government are designed to alienate them from their religion and culture. And this is a fact. Now you take this matter of plural marriage. Whenever I speak to a group of Christians and I'm unprepared, I ask them to tell me what are the first thoughts that come into their minds when they think of Muslim Filipinos. And almost always the first thing that comes to the mind, and I write it on the blackboard, was that, Muslims are allowed to have more than one wife. That's the first thing. The second thing is that they're violent. etc., etc. The Quran does indeed limit, sets a limit to the number of wives that a Muslim can have. And that is not more than 4 at a time. And the Quran sanctions divorce. Under certain circumstances, a Muslim may have more than one wife, up to a limit of 4. And by the way, this is a limitation. In the Arabia of the Prophet's day, it was customary to have many, many more than 4 wives. And he was introducing a kind of social reform in putting a limitation of 4. Now, I've just made a mistake. I say he was introducing a reform. Now, from a Christian point of view, that I'll get away with that. But if Muslims were here, devout Muslims, they would immediately get up and say, it is not Muhammad who puts the limit of 4. It is God. The Quran is the word of God. The word, as Dr. Hawk has been stressing, the word of God and booked. Now, in point of fact, a very small number of Muslim Filipinos have more than one wife at a time. There is divorce. Of all the things Allah allows, He hates divorce the most. He allows it, He hates it. This is a hadith. Of all the things Allah allows, He hates divorce the most. And that is an Islamic attitude towards divorce, by the way. But it is permitted. And the Quran sets down conditions under which divorce may be permitted. And conditions under which a marriage to more than one wife may be allowed. In point of fact, as I said, very, very, very few Muslims are married to more than one wife. And the generality of Muslims practice monogamy. Not out of religious conviction. Their religious conviction is that, well, we can have more than one up to a limit of 4. But they have not more than one out of economic circumstances or whatever. Right? Now, the Philippine government comes along and passes a law based on a Roman Catholic Christian morality. You cannot be married to more than one wife, and there will be no divorce. Now, Christians would be inclined to say, well, this is a social issue. This isn't a religious issue, this is a social issue, really. It's a social legislation. But Muslims regard this as a religious question. Why? Because God's law, written in the Quran, permits, under certain conditions, plural marriage and divorce. And it is therefore religiously unacceptable from the Muslim point of view, although a number of secularizing Muslim countries, in point of fact, have laws for monogamy now. But now, from a Muslim religious point of view, it is unacceptable for man to interpose a law which negates or violates what God has permitted in the Quran. And so for them, this whole matter of, look, give us a code of personal laws and make it part of the Philippine legal system that applies to Muslim citizens. And have this code of personal law based on the Quran and the Sharia. We demand this as a matter of human right. We do not interfere with the religious freedom of Christians. Don't interfere with the religious freedom of Muslims. Let us be free to be Muslim. Respect our religion. Well, and I could go on and point to other issues that Christians do not regard as religious questions. But in point of fact, from the Muslim point of view, they are religious issues. And from the Muslim point of view, the struggle in the South is to a very great extent, a religious war. And Christians are horrified. Christians are horrified. Ever since the 17th century, ever since the terrible 30 Years' War, when Christians in the West, anyway, became quite ashamed of fighting wars of religion, which were, of course, mixed in with all kinds of economic and political factors, Christians have been horrified at the idea that they fight religious wars. But in point of fact, what's happening in Northern Ireland, if it isn't to a great extent a religious struggle? So, as I say, the Muslims are in very much an age of faith, which Bob McCamus, my dear friend, would say is a futile struggle since they are spiritually dead. And the Christian Filipinos are in an age of politics. And let me say again, in an age of faith, all politics are religious. And in an age of politics, all religion is political. And you have this essential struggle and failure in understanding between Muslims and Christians. All right, let me end by saying something about secession. As I say, the Muslims are caught in suspension between integration and secession. They repudiate integration insofar as integration suggests assimilation, absorption, the loss of their religious and cultural identity as it is absorbed into the identity of the majority population. They repudiate that. And one Muslim scholar, Alunan Glan, has suggested an alternative word and an alternative concept, which he calls orchestration. Orchestration. What we want in terms of national unity is not the loss of our cultural and religious individualities. What we want is orchestration, where these different cultures will work together harmoniously for agreed upon national goals. And when you stop to think about the concept orchestration, an orchestra is made up of many different instruments. There's the piano, and there's the violin. And then I just saw a new instrument here the other night. I had never seen a saw being played. And that certainly should be one of the classic instruments in an orchestra from now on, along with the steel band, these steel drums, right? But, I mean, there are various instruments that make up the orchestra, and if you are not to have discordant music, you must find ways of harmonizing the music made by these different instruments. I think the idea of orchestration is an attractive one, and it is certainly one that that Muslims who agree to be part of the Philippine Republic can live with. Now, it is my own very, very strong feeling that secession will never happen. It simply will not happen. And I suspect that the Moro National Liberation Front has, in its early years, stressed that it was a struggle for secession as a political ploy. You know, you've got to ask for the moon in order to get you won't get the moon, but you may get something closer to the moon. And I think that the MNLF claimed an extreme desire for secession in order to get concessions that are an improvement over the present situation, though it's not complete independence. And the fact is that the MNLF now says the struggle is not for secession, but for autonomy. Autonomy, where Muslims will have a large measure of reserved powers over their religion, over their education, over their internal security, powers of local legislation, powers of local taxation, shared powers of exploitation of natural resources in their own homeland, power over internal security, etc. Now, as those of us who are Americans can smile a little bit, every state in the Union of the United States of America has reserved powers over local legislation, taxation, education, internal security, etc., etc. Every state has its own flag, its own seal, its own internal army or police force, in some cases a state song, etc., etc. And yet we manage to come together in a federal relationship. Well, both Muslim radicals, those who are out fighting in the hills as MNLF, and Muslim moderates are agreed that what is needed in the long-range solution to the moral problem is genuine, honest-to-goodness, genuine autonomy. Not this sham we call autonomy, but it's exactly the opposite of autonomy. Huh? All right, now, I want to say very quickly... very quickly. It's nice to have this support from the people in the field. I want to recite very quickly three reasons why I believe that secession cannot possibly happen. First of all, it is very difficult to define the area of independence. What part of the southern Philippines or parts of the southern Philippines would be included in an independent Islamic state? The fact is, Muslim Filipinos have never occupied the whole island of Mindanao. Also, you have the fact that in Mindanao and Sulu, you've got 14 million people, only 2 million of whom are Muslim. If it is the 13 provinces that are supposed to be made up into the area of autonomy right now, it would have economic viability. But it would not have political viability. Because in those 13 provinces, you have 6 million people, only 2 million of them Muslim. 4 million are mostly Christians, with loyalties and ties to the Philippine Republic. So you would not have political viability if the area of independence was the 13 provinces. If the area of independence were the 5 provinces that are left today with absolute Muslim majorities, you might have some degree of political viability, but you would not have economic viability, because those 5 provinces are among the poorest economically, in terms of resources, among the poorest provinces in Mindanao and Sulu. The second reason why secession is probably not possible is that there is no international support for a Muslim independence movement in the southern Philippines. No Muslim government is supporting an independence struggle. Libya has been supporting a struggle for autonomy, but not secession. There is no international support for Muslim independence in the southern Philippines. If Indonesia and or Malaysia were to give such support, we might have quite a different story to tell in the southern Philippines. And the third reason, and with this I close, the third reason why secession is not going to happen is that the Filipino people will not tolerate it. The Republic of the Philippines with Mindanao and Sulu is firmly entrenched as part of the national concept. And Filipino nationalism would not tolerate in any way, shape, or manner the dismemberment of the territorial dismemberment of the Republic of the Philippines. And if the Muslim Filipinos were to escalate their war for secession or independence, there would be, and has already been, a corresponding escalation of Republic of the Philippines suppression of such an idea. Thank you very much. I retire until this afternoon.